Right. This is a custom of on major holidays to try to act like a bodhisattva or an arhat for a whole day. So the idea is, in the morning you take, you swear to keep certain vows, like I won't kill anybody today, I won't steal anything of value, you know, and also I won't eat after noon, and I won't eat meat and things like that. There are certain, they're easy vows, not such a big deal. And it's a very powerful thing to do, you know, on major holidays. To me, this is the most important holiday of the year. It's the day that the Buddha first decided to teach something. He was enlightened for a certain period and didn't want to teach. He stayed in the forest and said, nobody will get it. And then finally he decided to start teaching. So it's a very auspicious day to... you dedicate the whole day to watching yourself very carefully. Your mind and what you say and what you do to other people. So it's like a special day of watchfulness about your own behavior. And it's a very good custom to do it. And if you do it enough times, then it starts to get into your subconscious, okay? If you get there late, just go home, because please don't ring the bell, because we're on probation there. We made too much noise. The other owners of the building complained. And we have to be very sensitive. All we need is for someone to ring the other owner's bell at 5 in the morning. And, you know, so please be considerate. Try to be there by 5. If you're waiting out on the steps at 4:45 because you got there early because you didn't want to be late, try to be quiet. Okay? Pretend you're the homeless person who's shooting up on the steps. Okay? Which they seem not to mind. Okay. All right. Okay. Okay. All right. We're doing a second part of Bodhisattva vows. Last week we covered all the root vows. Whether you remember it or not. tonight we're going to talk about some other issues about the vows, and about a few of the special secondary vows. I'd like to get in your mind the role of the vows and what they're supposed to do for you, okay? I think it's important to know the whole evolution of what's supposed to happen here. So I'd say, you know, first you due to your past lives, we don't believe that your mind began with the beginning of the physical body, okay? Due to your past memories, you're attracted... You know, you have some attraction to a spiritual path in this life. And different people have different attractions, and different people have different levels of attraction, and different people turn on at different times in their life. Some people it may be when they're 15 years old, some people maybe when they're 30, some people when they're 50, but we call bhakti-kshepa. At some point, your mind gets attracted to spiritual things. We believe in Buddhism that it's because you spent literally thousands of years working on it. And if you come into this life and you have any attraction to spiritual things, there's a reason for it. And it's because you've been working on it for a long time. Okay? Then you... normally you have some kind of disaster. Okay? This is very desirable. Okay? For me, my mother died, you know, young. My father died, my brother died, all in the same year. It wakes you up to the nature of this life, you know? You get a wake-up call. I know very serious Buddhists in their 60s who the important moment was when they were 30 or 25, and the one I'm thinking of, her daughter was crushed by a truck while her husband was holding the daughter's hand. And things like that, you know, something wakes you up to the fact that you must die and that there's nothing else in this realm. In the world that we live in, what you have to look forward to is death, old age, losing the people you love, losing the things you love. And then you begin to question, is there anything I can do about it, or is that just inevitable? So at some point you get a wake-up call, all right? Then you meet you know, I guess normally you read some books, right? Or you hear about it in the newspaper. You know, people pick up a book by the Dalai Lama, or they're watching TV and they see His Holiness for a few minutes, or I remember reading a comic book. I think it's Doctor Strange or something like that. And he's in a Tibetan cave and he's learning all this great stuff, and they got these cool robes, and, you know, and it just caught my eye. You know, I mean, then I get to college, my mom's dying of cancer, who never heard a fly, you know, and I pick up this Buddhist book about suffering. And I thought, wow, these, at least they are asking the right question. You know what I mean? So I think you make your first contact, some kind of loose contact, you know, and then it may take years before it really sinks in. Then you go to your first classes. And I remember my first classes. I think that's why I can appreciate being a student. I remember my first classes. I was very nervous. I remember getting off the bus in India. I remember trying to read my first Tibetan book, not understanding half the words, too many Sanskrit words in there. I remember trying to make the sounds of Tibetan, nah. I remember walking up the mountain trying to say nah, nah, you know, I'd go into class, is it, they'd say no, go back home, you know, come back tomorrow, you know. And I remember all these things. I remember how uncomfortable it was. I remember feeling very uncomfortable when people prostrated, you know what I mean? And how uncomfortable that felt to see people do that. And I remember how weird it was to see a man in a dress, a red dress, and barefoot, and things like that. You know, I still remember all those things. And so there's a, you go to your first classes, and they're a little bit, the cultural stuff is sticky. You know, hopefully we can smooth that over in the future. But there are cultural issues where they're doing certain things that are unusual for us. And they don't mean the same things. To walk around with your head shaved in New York, for a guy, means you're dangerous. For a woman, it means you're looking for another girl. And, you know, and you know, you get called Hare Krishna when you walk down the street. And you know, it's all cultural things that have trouble. And you have trouble with those things. But you overcome them, you get to your first classes. I think then you get your first intellectual understandings. I mean, understandings. And this is where you start to go to more classes and you get the intellectual framework of Buddhism. Okay, I understand it's not just coming from nowhere. There's a reason why people die. There's a reason why people get old. There's a reason why the accidents in my life happened. You know, there's some kind of intellectual reason why I might be able to get out of this problem. And you start to have some understanding of it intellectually. You start coming to classes, you do your homeworks, you do your quizzes, things like that. Some people, between this stage and this stage, takes a long time. You know, they come to their first classes and they keep coming, but they don't really think. You know, they keep coming because it's they like the people there, they like the feeling of the place. But the real intellectual work is going on very slowly. Then at some point, it's sort of the screw turns up and you start getting more serious and you start thinking harder, and then certain realizations start to happen to you. Okay, then you start your first daily practice. I saw an interesting article about when Time magazine did an article about Buddhism in America. They were saying the interesting thing about Buddhism is that people do it in their homes and not at church. Like, it's not an hour a week on Sundays at church. I think in almost every form of Buddhism that has reached the United States, although they're all very different, mostly you're encouraged to make an altar in your home, make a place in your home where you meditate in the morning. And most Buddhists are considering it like half an hour to an hour and a half every morning. It's not unusual to be praying or meditating in front of your altar every morning. And that's a big difference. So at some point in your career, you start doing your daily practice. If you meditate every day, you start to have unusual things start happen to you, like very good things. Like if you start meditating regularly, you notice that you're better able to focus, you're better able to do your work during the day, office work or whatever you do. You find yourself happier, you find yourself more compassionate towards other people, you find your relationships improving, things like that. All this effect of meditation starts to happen to you. Then you hear about vows, and we're getting into that. We said last week, last class, when I say vows, I hesitate to use the word vows. It has so many negative connotations. When you say vow to somebody, what you often think of is somebody in Europe in 1400s, you know, they got pregnant out of wedlock. The family wanted to get them out of the picture. They send them to a convent. The child is given away, and the woman never comes out, and she's under vows. And or something like that. There's always this connotation of, in my mind, when I was growing up, people who are frustrated, restricted by their vows, they don't really like their vows, or they're struggling against their vows, and the vows are like chains that are holding them back from their true nature, and they're struggling their whole life against their real nature. And that was the impression of vows that I had as a young person in this country. You, again, as we said last time, you have to think of vows in a different way. Vows are like, Matthieu Ricard said, wings. You know, it's a list of things that if you do it, your whole life changes, okay? And you just have to think of it that way. I feel very strongly that before people give vows, they should explain what vows do for you. I mean, each of these steps you've been through, you know, up to the vows thing, each of you has gone through some part of this process, and you got here. And a lot of you have finished a lot of courses. So you have the whole intellectual outline of Buddhism very clear in your mind. And if you are meditating regularly, you are getting some kind of really special changes in your mind from that. But you have to go one more step and think about vows, okay? You have to think about making a commitment to certain kinds of behavior, okay? And these are not like stupid things like you can't eat ice cream, you can't go see a movie, you know? It's not like that. These are, the Bodhisattva vows are very powerful vows that all relate to serving other people and getting into the idea of devoting your life to other people, making a commitment to devote your life to other people. And then that is a very liberating experience. When you start keeping those vows, your whole world changes. And what I meant to say was, each time you move from one of these steps to the next step, your reality shifts. Okay? And that's what I want you to appreciate. Each time you go up another step along this ladder, your reality shifts. Okay, I'm not saying you have a different attitude about your life. I'm not saying you feel better or worse about other people or something like that. The colors and sounds and the people you meet and the things that happen to you shift another 10 degrees. Okay, you got to get used to that. Okay, we're talking about changing reality itself. When you move to from here to here, your reality shifts 10 degrees. And there are still a certain percentage of people who are in your old reality who don't really understand what you're doing. You see, I mean, because they don't see the world that way. We say that there's an energy or a power. The closer you get to acting in a spiritual way, the more your reality will shift. And people who are still down here, you know, who don't have any interest in these things, they literally see the world differently than you. You know, to them the world is a more threatening place. To them you have to be tough, and you have to be aggressive, and you have to watch out for your own interests, because the world is dangerous, and the world is a competitive place, and you must take care of number one, or you're going to be taken advantage of, or you won't have enough to eat, or your family won't have a house to stay in, or something like that. And as you move up, reality itself changes. As you start to get around here, it's totally shifted around. Your perception of the world is that other people are starting to change all around you. The people around you are actually taking care of you. You know, you start to, as you get higher and higher in the process, you become more and more like a child, and the whole world is taking care of you. and you don't have to worry about a thing. And it's not a naive thing. Like, I was in business for 16 years, corporate life, millions and millions of dollars. It's not naivety, and it's not avoiding the real world. It's the real world starts to change. And everything starts to work better, because you know how to make things work. You see what I mean? And anything you want to accomplish, you can accomplish. And extraordinary changes around you start to happen. Extraordinary shifts in the reality around you as you move up. And that's the whole point. You see what I mean? And if this person meets this person, they see the world differently. You know, this person thinks this person is naive. This person feels sorry for this person, that they're still struggling. You know, to what? To collect things so you can die with them? You know what I mean? I mean, and still this person doesn't understand how to get things the right way. And this person has more things than they know what to do with. This person has trouble getting rid of all the money and things that people give them. You know what I mean? And you know, filling out financial reports to account for all the money they were given. You see what I mean? Stuff like that. And it's not any kind of, it's just happening to them because they understand karma. And they understand vows. You see what I mean? So what I'm trying to say is this. You have an opportunity with bodhisattva vows to switch to a whole different reality. It's a whole higher level of seeing the world. If you start acting day by day, hour by hour, according to your bodhisattva vows, you can count on a major shift in the reality around you. And I'm not saying that you become a different person or like that. The actual reality, the sounds, tastes, physical world around you, and your own mind start to change. And isn't that the whole point? You know, isn't that the whole idea? Isn't that why you went on a spiritual path in the first place? You were hoping something like this happens. Okay, so you go through, take your bodhisattva vows. By the way, you start with Patimoksha vows, okay? Which you can call freedom vows. These are very basic, okay? Agreeing not to kill a human or a fetus. Agreeing not to steal any major amount of money. Agreeing not to commit adultery with another person's wife or husband. Agreeing not to lie about your spiritual life. Agreeing not to use drugs or alcohol. Okay? I mean, basically those five. Okay? When you take those five for your life, and then when you start keeping them carefully, your reality shifts another 10 degrees. And people who haven't taken them can't appreciate it. You know, you try to explain to them, I've been keeping these five vows now for about 3 years, and food tastes better, music sounds better, I meet nicer people, my finances have changed. You know, and they can't understand it because they're just in a different reality, they're in a different place. But if you take these vows and keep them, life starts to change. That's the whole idea. By the way, when you get around 360 degrees, I guess it's 180, okay? To be 18 major spiritual levels or something. You're in heaven. You're what they call paradise. We believe you can do it. We can believe you can go there. We don't believe you have to look weird or act any different. To us, you might look exactly the same. But your personal experience of reality would be totally blissful. Totally happy. And you would be surrounded by extraordinary people. And then as we watched you, you might look like a normal person. Okay? So you have to get used to that idea. Each person's perceptions of their reality only depends on how far along this ladder they've gotten. And there is no base reality. There is no standard reality. It's only what each person is seeing. Okay? So which way do you want to be is the only question. You can design it. So you got to take your Patimoksha vows. Then you take Bodhisattva vows. And the idea is just to get a new list of vows, a new list of activities that if you keep these, your reality shifts another 10%. You get 10% closer to the opposite of what you grew up with. What you started out in this life with is certain death, certain loss of all the things you've ever owned, certain loss of all the people you've ever met, certain loss of your identity, your mind, your body, everything. That's what you started with. And each time you go up a little bit, it shifts. The reality shifts like that. Each time you move up the spiritual ladder, you start to get shifts like that. Okay? Then you take your secret vows. And if you keep them well, you accomplish the whole 180 degree turn. Okay? You're about here when you take your secret vows. You still have friends from high school back here, not interested in spiritual things at all. Then to try to talk to them about what's happening to you is very difficult. You know what I mean? I mean, it's a Buddhist principle that no two people see the world the same way exactly. Because the world is empty. Meaning, you only see what you've prepared in your mind. If you've been good to other people, you see the world in a certain way. If you've been bad to other people, you see the world in a different way. So, as you move up the vows, you're becoming different from other people. You're seeing the world differently. You're having different experiences. You might look even strange to them. You probably do, actually. Okay? And by the way, I'm not saying in a way that you say, oh, you poor guy, you know, you never took vows. I did. I'm much better than you. You just don't understand what's happening to me. You know, go away, or something like that. You know, not like that. I'm not saying like that. And we can never tell that the person that you're looking at is not a fully enlightened being already. Okay? Never sure of that. I'm not saying in a way of judging other people. I'm just saying, if you go through this process, your reality starts to shift in clicks. In the diamond business, we call it clicks. When you cut a diamond, you have clicks. You know, 10 degrees, 20 degrees, 30 degrees. It's called a click stop. So your reality is just moving up different clicks. And then it reaches enlightenment. Okay? So the trick here is called six times. Many Americans, many Westerners have taken vows, different sets of vows. Some have taken basic morality vows. Some have taken ordination vows. Many have taken bodhisattva vows. Many have taken secret vows. Okay? And then you say, hey, did you notice all those shifts in your world when you started to keep them? And they say, no. And then you say, you know, can you tell me just how you're keeping them? And they say, well, you know, I generally know them and I try to be a good person. And you say, no, I want to know, are you checking them? And they say, what do you mean checking? You know, when I do and I watch, and you know, I don't kill people. I try not to kill people in general. But you say, no, are you checking them throughout the day? Like every 2 hours or so, do you check them? And this is a custom in Buddhism. You have to do it. Okay, whatever vows you have, you're supposed to check them throughout the day. Six times a day, by tradition, you stop. You stop what you're doing, wherever you are, whatever time it is. I love the Muslim custom. I love the Hasidic custom. I worked in a Hasidic diamond cutting factory. Every couple of hours, the Moshe would stand up and go stand in the corner, and he'd go like this, you know. And they're doing their prayers. And they don't care if the guy's waiting outside with a $100,000 order of diamonds. The prayers are more important. In the Diamond Dealers Club in New York, there's a special room for prayer. And when the hour comes, everyone goes in. And that's it. And that's more important than the business. You see what I mean? We're supposed to be doing the same thing. Okay, every 2 hours or so, six times a day, stop. Check your next vow. You must do it. What I'm saying is that it's one thing to take these vows. Well, it's one thing to learn them. It's a second thing to take them. But it's a whole different thing to keep them. Okay? If you don't keep them, then these vows don't do anything. And if you come to 18 different courses here and you work your butt off for 7 years and learn all this, the details of Buddhist philosophy, which are endless, you won't change. Okay? It won't change you that much. You must be following some noble code of conduct, you know, and you must be checking yourself every few hours. Or just to have a general mood where you'd like to be a good person doesn't work, because we come into this world pretty wild. And you have to have some discipline. You have to be able every few hours check your mind, see where your mind is, and check the next vow. You know, did I lie to anybody in the last 2 hours? Okay? By the way, by tomorrow you won't remember all the lies you told today. Okay? That's just human nature. You know, those of you like me who go to bed and forgot to check the last 2 vows, by the next morning you can't remember what happened yesterday. You know, it's got to be fresh. And unless you change your behavior, your conduct, unless you examine yourself every few hours, you can't expect Buddhism to do a thing for you. You're just fooling yourself. You can be able to answer every single question on these homeworks and do all the quizzes in Urdu and in Sanskrit and in Tibetan. But if you don't understand the vows and then take them and then watch them, it won't have any effect on you. And there, I meet hundreds of Americans every year who can attest to that fact. Yeah, if you don't believe me, I can refer to you to a few of them. You know, they took vows 20 years ago. They never learned them properly. They don't know exactly what they are. They definitely don't check them hour by hour. And they haven't changed. And nothing's happened to them. And then there's people who do keep them. The beauty of Bodhisattva vows is you can start out a real schmuck, but if you keep them every few hours, you actually become a beautiful person after a while. You see what I mean? They work. They really work. So it doesn't matter what your original condition is. You know, however you start, it's okay. Just know them, check them, and then inevitably you start to change. And what's changing really is the reality around you. And you gotta get into that mode. Then when you take higher vows, everything makes sense. Everything they talk about in the higher teachings makes total sense. It's totally clear. Everything's coming true. All those experiences that you ever read about in Dr. Strange comic books start to happen to you, or the New Testament or whatever. They all start to actually happen, you know, to you. I was in Ireland, and they were so exciting. The people were keeping their vows, and things were starting to happen to them. And they said, this is exactly what was described in the Bible. I thought it would only happen 2,000 years ago. I didn't think it could happen nowadays, you know? The idea was that all the amazing things that you read in the Bible were only happening 2,000 years ago and can't happen now. And that's not true. If you keep these vows, all those extraordinary things that you ever dreamed of will start happening to you. So what I'm trying to say is this class tonight about Bodhisattva vows is really important. It's the way to go up about another 20 degrees automatically. And like exercise, it just requires maintenance on a regular basis. It requires a small amount of effort every couple of hours. It doesn't take more than 2 minutes for the exercise of writing down how you did on that vow. In fact, once you get used to it, you can do it about 10 seconds. But it just has to be done every few hours. And then things change. All the miracles you ever heard about in the Bible start to happen. And it doesn't matter how dumb spiritually your mind was when you started. The beauty of the Bodhisattva vows is that an omniscient being has chosen 64 things to concentrate on. And if you do it, no matter how bad you are, you start to get incredible. You just have to keep doing it on a regular basis, okay? So it's like you can go from 64-pound weakling to Arnold Schwarzenegger without the heart attack, okay? You just have to keep them, okay? All you have to do is check them every few hours. It doesn't matter how grumpy or how uncompassionate your mind is. Understand the vows, check them every few hours, you'll be Mother Teresa in short order. I'm not kidding. That's the power of this system, okay? Okay, now we'll go over the actual class. I'm not going to do much Tibetan because we don't have that much time. Having covered the major vows, we're now discussing some details of how you keep the vows. Okay, and I think the first thing to say is when you take pratimoksha or freedom vows, they are lifetime vows. When you take the vow, they say, Jisitsoi Pardu, means until the day I die, I will keep these vows. Now, bodhisattva vows are different. You don't lose them when you die. And the same with tantric vows, okay? Once you take them once, you don't lose them even if you die. You carry them on to your next life, okay? People have asked me, well, what's it feel like? You know what I mean? How do you know when you're 6 months old in your next life and you're just trying to get the bottle out of your mom's hand? How are you supposed to keep your vows, and how do you remember them? No, you don't, okay? At a certain process, at a certain point in your life, you might be 15, you might be 20, something like that, 25. Bhaktaksepa, the seed reawakens, and you start following them, you start keeping them, you start to be exposed to people who are keeping them, you start to meet teachers who know about them, and that's just a natural process for someone who's been keeping them. To even hear about these holy methods of conducting your life is very rare. It, according to us, it takes many, many years of effort on your part to have the karma to meet a person who will explain them to you. By the time you've heard the explanation of them, by the time you've taken them, and especially if you're keeping them, we say that you probably won't come out of contact with those people. You see what I mean? If you just keep them in a pretty general way, in a pretty sincere way, you will be taken care of after you die also. Okay? The people will be there. They will bring you up. They will help you. They will be guiding you. You will make contact with it again. And that's an automatic thing for a person who has been sincere in keeping this code of life, this code of conduct, okay? But you can lose the vows, okay? Now, if you can't get rid of them when you die, how can you get rid of them? Okay? Three different ways, all right? Three different ways. First one is what we call wrong views, wrong world views, okay? I'll give you the classic one. The classic wrong worldview is if I hurt another person, and if nobody's watching, I can get away with it. There are no repercussions. There is no moral law like gravity in the world, you know? There is no universal law that if for every moral action there is a moral reaction. See, I mean, to say that and to believe that if I hurt someone else and get away fast enough, nothing will happen to me. See what I mean? If I can steal money from their room and they don't see me, you know? If I can close my door and do bad things and no one sees me, then I'm home free. Okay? To believe that, to have that viewpoint deeply held, to commit yourself to that viewpoint, ruins the vows. You will lose the vows. Okay? It destroys your vows. Okay? Now, some of us have doubts at times, okay? And I think, if you think about it, by definition, if you ever hurt another living being, you are expressing doubt in this principle. And we do that all day long. You know, we continue to lie, we continue to cheat people, we continue to be irritated at people or to say, now does that constitute giving up this vow? What do you think? No, I mean, in practice, it's an expression. It's like spitting on the principle of moral, universal moral principle. But in your heart, you're not like rejecting it, you know? You're saying, I'm too weak to follow it properly, but I don't reject the principle. I know that every time I know intellectually that every time I hurt some living thing, something will come back to me. Now, I may be too weak to follow, you know, to reflect that in my own behavior, but I don't reject the principle. As long as you don't reject the principle actively, strongly, you don't smash your vows, okay? Jethro Gobbo has an interesting thing in there. Well, what if I have a 20-minute attack of wrong view? Do I lose my vows? You see what I mean? And it like tries to figure out how long does it have to go on for, you know? And I think the general thing is it would be like weeks or months, you see what I mean? It's not like all of us have days when we think the whole world is, you know, terrible. and everything doesn't matter what we were doing. And you don't lose the balance. It has to be an extended period of weeks or months, something like that, where you actively and consciously reject the principle that all actions have their reactions, that all moral actions, good or bad, done to other people, somehow comes back to you. Okay, that's the first one. First way to lose your vows, forever, okay? Not forever, but until you take them again. By the way, you can take them again in this life. You can take them 10 minutes later, okay? It's okay. They will be restored. They will not be as perfect as they were the first time. And it does have an indelible effect on your ability to see emptiness directly, for example, in this life. Okay? It greatly reduces your chances. But otherwise, you can take them again. Okay? And they're okay. They're real bodhisattva vows. Okay? Second way, to actively give up the idea of compassion for other beings. Okay? To say, I formally give up on the idea of bodhicitta. I give up on the idea that I could become some kind of a holy being and be of service to other people. That I myself could become a Mother Teresa or a Jesus or a Moses or a Manjushri and be of help to other people. To give up on that principle, to say that's impossible and I reject the idea and I refuse to try to do it myself, which is to give up bodhicitta. Then you break your root vows. You lose the vows. Okay? By the way, when you lose one vow, you lose all of them. You see what I'm saying? When you lose this vow, you lose all of them. Okay? And you can't just have to take the one over. You have to take all of them over. Okay? You have to get used to that. So now these are two very extreme views. By the way, they can't be just a bad day. You have to entertain and hold these viewpoints strongly for weeks or months, you know, and formally in your mind say, I give up on the principle of trying to reach a high spiritual level so that I can be of help to other people. I reject the idea, I reject the principle, I refuse to think about it for 6 more months. You see what I mean? It has to be that strong. Okay? What if you have doubts about these principles? I mean, what if you have honest doubts about the idea of karma? What if it seems to you like certain things can happen outside of the laws of karma? Do you break your bodhisattva vows? No. Okay? Active questioning of the principles of Buddhism is required. Okay? If you come up against an idea in the teachings that you have trouble with, you're required to not accept it. Okay? And you have to get used to that. You're required to put it on the shelf. Maitreya says, let's make a distinction. You don't reject it actively, but you say, for the time being, I can't accept this particular idea. For example, future life. Okay? I don't have any personal proof, my own perception, of future lives. You hear in the National Enquirer that certain guy remembers his uncle's dog from his last life, you know, but it doesn't seem convincing to me. You know what I mean? And I heard Michael Roach's logical arguments, and they don't convince me. They sound good. They kind of lead me to believe there may be a future life, but I have trouble accepting it undoubtedly. You see what I mean? Without any kind of doubt. And that's honest, and that doesn't break your vows. You see what I mean? That's actually keeping your vows. And then you say, I will shelve that idea for right now. So there's a big difference between active rejection and active doubt. Okay? Doubt is encouraged, rejection is foolish. Okay? Don't reject something you can't see, because it might be there. My boss, in this huge corporation, I used to go out and beg for some money for the refugee children, and he'd give me like $10,000. Like, boom. And I'd say, why are you doing this? You're not Buddhist, you're Jewish, you're Israeli, you know. He'd say, hey, I'm covering my bases, you know. you know, and that's the attitude. You see, my trainer said, put it on the shelf, you know. Just say, okay, maybe it's true, I'll get back to you later. I'll come back to that one next year. when we take another course, you know, but right now I'm not ready to buy that. You're supposed to think like that. That's not losing your bodhisattva vows. Bodhisattva vows, ruining them is saying, I reject actively, there's positively no such thing as a future life. Okay? Then you're actually destroying your vows. Okay, so we got wrong viewpoints, worldviews, strongly held over an extended period of time, decisively held, and then we got losing your compassion for other people, deciding definitively you will not try to help them by reaching some high spiritual level. Okay? Now, last week we talked about how many root vows? 16?
18.
Okay. By the way, so two of them you can, two out of the 18 you can break your vows and you lose the vows and you have to take them over again. Okay, now, that leaves 16 others. What happens if you break those? If you break them in what we call a major boo-boo, then you lose your vows. Okay, what's a major boo-boo? Four things have to be present. Okay, so we're talking right now, this is question one on your homework, okay? That always gets attention. Four major boo-boos you have to make. Sorry, four parts have to be complete for you to make a major boo-boo that wipes out your vows. Okay? And I'm going to give them to you now. Those of you who know Tundru, Gangu Lota Chame Kundishi, you like that, okay? Here they're called the four chains, by the way. Kunti is an ancient word in the Abhidharma for a chain or something that binds you, okay? Chudumalopa. Chudumalopa means you'd happily do this thing again. Okay, what's the first bodhisattva about? Praising your particular, actually it's Mahayana religious tradition, and putting down another religious tradition, okay? And knowing that it's all false, for example. Like accusing a certain teacher of something and knowing that it's not true, but just you want people to admire you and give you money or like that, pay respect to you, so you maliciously say something about other people's religious traditions. Like, this is the most wrong thing you can do, okay, in a bodhisattva vow. Now, if you did it once, and you caught yourself, and you said, oh, hey, stupid, don't do that, because you were checking your book, right, you don't lose your vows. You see? If you say, I'm sorry I did it, you see? But if you say, I'd be glad to do it again, that's the first of the four chains. Don't forget, all four have to be present for you to blow your vows. So it's already hard to do. If you have the slightest bit of compunction about having broken a vow, you don't lose your vows. Okay? Jetsun Kampa, guess what he's asking in his commentary? How soon do I have to have the compunction? Okay? Like, do I have to be sorry within 24 hours, or can I be sorry a week later, or, you know? And he's not very clear in saying the truth. It's more like, let's say a few weeks or months, you don't retract yourself, okay? You say, still 6 months later, or a few weeks later, you're still saying, yeah, and I'd be happy to do it again. Yeah, I did lie, I did say something malicious about that other Dharma teacher so I could get all the money in town. And I'd love to do it again, you know, if another guy shows up. Okay? Second one. We call Lota Cheme. Lota Cheme means two different versions of consideration or shame. And I'll explain the difference, okay? There's two different versions here. Lota Mepa means you have no regrets about what you did as far as your own image of yourself. You see? What I mean is, you don't have any pride in your own image. What I mean to say is, you don't have any regrets about it. Like, if no one else ever knew you committed this thing, but you knew, you'd be able to live with yourself. See what I mean? Is that okay? Alright? What's the opposite of that? Which is what we're supposed to aspire to. You see, shame. We call it shame. But how we define shame in Buddhism is, even if no one else ever knew I did this, I'd be embarrassed to know that Michael Roach did it. Okay? That's called shame. Okay? It's avoiding a bad deed because you yourself wouldn't like to think of yourself as being a person that would do that. Okay? It's just some kind of self-image you have of yourself. And you'd be embarrassed if you looked in the mirror in the morning and said, that guy did this thing. Okay? That's the first one. First half, okay? Second half is, you could care less about the effects of your action on other people. We call that lack of consideration. Okay? Like, if I break this vow, it will hurt 50 other people. And you're like, I don't care. You know? I could care less about how this is going to impact on other people. That's called lack of consideration. Okay? If you break one of the 18 root vows with this attitude, I don't care how I look to myself, and I don't care how I look to others, I'm going to break it anyway. Okay, then you've got two of the four elements required to blow the vows completely. Now, we're already in a situation which is very difficult to attain. I'd be happy to do this terrible thing again. And I also don't care about how I look to myself or how I look to other people. Okay, that's already pretty hard. It's getting hard to break this vow, right? It's getting hard to lose your vows. What's number three? Gangu. Gangu means when you did this bad thing, you felt happy. Like great pleasure. You take pleasure. You don't just break a vow. You're like breaking it with relish. You know, like, I felt good. You know, okay. Yeah, I maligned that other Dharma teacher and I saw those people's faces and I saw the checkbooks come out for me and I felt great. Okay? That's how it would feel to break the first one, for example. Okay? So, it's already getting to be, you've got to be almost an evil person, I think, to really smash a bodhisattva vow properly. Okay? So those are the first three. Okay, what's number four? Nimigmita. This is the worst one, by the way. Nimigmita means, if someone came up to you and said, don't you realize that what you did is a bad thing? You'd say, no, it's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. It's not to consider it wrong. Okay? Not to consider what you did wrong. Do you realize that you just broke your first bodhisattva vow? That out of a desire to clean these people's pockets out in your class, you were maligning this other religious tradition or this other teacher? And you say, yeah, I understood that. Okay? And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Okay? And to believe it, you see what I mean? In your heart. Then you've got the fourth element. When these four elements are present with any of the root bodhisattva vows, you have destroyed the vows. You must take them over. Okay? And you already see how difficult it is. You've got to have all four present. Okay? Yeah?
But fourth is present, the fourth one, that you don't consider the leader as something wrong.
Yeah.
Automatically the other three.
Say again? Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, Axel points out that by the time you, if you get number four by itself, you're probably going to cover the other three automatically. Yeah, there's a discussion like that in the scriptures, you know. Pretty much by the time you get to number four, you're probably... Oh, you might not consider it bad, but you might not feel happy doing it. How's that? You see what I mean? That's conceivable, right? All right. Those Germans. All right. And this guy covered all this. I want to talk about one very special vow. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't catch that. What did
you
say?
If you don't think it's bad,
yeah,
then it's not so bad.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Karmically speaking, you know, for example, if you don't believe that a human fetus is a living being and you abort it, karmically speaking, it's not as strong. In other words, if you don't recognize it for what it is, It's less repercussions for you personally. Yeah, generally that's true. So that's true. There's sort of a paradox here. Okay. All right. There's a very special bodhisattva vow that if I don't talk about it, you might get in trouble. There's a vow that says, under extraordinary circumstances, you are required to break one of the first seven of the 10 basic vows of morality. Okay? Now these are three that you commit with your body, which are killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, And then four that you commit with your speech, which is lying, divisive talk, harsh talk, and then idle talk. Okay? So these are seven. So under extraordinary circumstances, for example, a guy runs into your house, Keanu Reeves, you know, and he's being chased by the agents. And these heartless robot beings. And he runs in and he says, "You gotta hide me in a closet." You say, "Okay, go to that one." You know, and he hides in the closet. And then there's a knock on the door and you open, there's this guy with sunglasses and the wire down the thing. And he says, "Have you seen Keanu Reeves?" You know, and he's got a gun, you know, like big lump here, you know. And you say, "Haven't seen him today." Okay, you're required to say, "I haven't seen him today," under special circumstances. Okay, that's all. That's all. Now, there are there are rules about this vow that you have to know. You know, Rinpoche, when we put the vows on a calendar a couple of years ago, he was very hesitant to even see this written, where people might be able to misunderstand it. There's a couple of exceptions here, and you have to know the exceptions. Technically speaking, this vow only applies to you if you've been on the Bodhisattva path for thousands of years and keeping it well. Technically speaking. I mean, the book says millions, okay? But I'm trying to make it easier. And so if you're not on a high spiritual level already, you don't have to worry about this vow, okay? All right? It doesn't technically apply to you. Now, should you still lie? That's a long question. I'm not going to get into it. But I just want to say that this is a very special vow. It's obviously a very dangerous vow if it's abused by people. So just be aware, it's to be used with caution. It's a very special vow. It's meant for people who are already very, very advanced in their practice and who can do extraordinary things. Now, why can't you break the last three? No one's allowed to break the last three for any reason. Why? These are mental. Okay? What's number eight? Sorry. Number eight is basically to be unhappy. I'm sorry. Okay. To be unhappy when somebody else gets something nice. I mean, that's basically number eight. You can call it craving. I don't like it so much. It's basically comparing yourself to others. Oh, she gets to do that, but I don't get to do that. I don't like that. Oh, she got a raise. I didn't get a raise. He pays attention to her. Doesn't pay attention to me. I don't like that. Okay? It's basically being unhappy when someone else gets something they want. Okay? Is there any condition under which it would be useful to break this vow? No. Okay? And it's the same with the other two mental vows. Ill will, which is the opposite of number eight, really. I'm happy you messed up today. You know? Oh, did you hear? So-and-so broke their vows, became a lay person, ruined their life. And you're like, "Oh, that's terrible, you know, tell me more," you know, and you know what I mean? And Dharma rumors especially, very sweet subject, okay? And to be happy that any other person is having trouble in their life, is there's never a case where doing this would be beneficial for anybody, okay? And then the last one, obviously, the wrong views one, you know, is there ever a case where it'd be beneficial to say karma doesn't work? Okay? No such thing. There's a special case for monks and nuns, ordained people. Okay? You are never allowed to break the sexual misconduct one under any circumstances. Period. If you have foresight for the next 5,000 years and you see that it happened, right, with a Sangha and Vasubandhu, Master Sangha Master Vasubandhu, that if this nun were to disrobe and have children, then there would be two great wise men born. So you should break your vows with this woman or something like that? No such thing. Okay? The commentary says you are required to disrobe first. Okay? If you see that this is some great benefit, or some, the classic one in the scriptures, this lady's got a gun to her head and says, "If you don't make love to me, you monk, I'll shoot myself." So you say, "Okay, out of compassion, I will, but I gotta disrobe first. Then you go to the altar and you disrobe and you do it, okay? But that's a special case, okay? You can't break that for anything, all right? Because of the effect it would have on the Dharma, okay? Next one. This is a very cool vow called the Four Points of Virtue. I'd like you to do that in your breakout sessions. Okay, that's number 5. And number 7 I'd like to talk about briefly. Okay, number 7 is called the Four White Deeds and the Four Black Deeds. There are all these extra vows that they don't tell you about when you take your Bodhisattva vows. Okay, it's not just 64 vows. There's another bunch of them, okay, that people never talk about much. I'm going to go over them briefly. The first white deed, these are called the four white deeds and the four black deeds, okay? Is never to speak a lie to any other person, even in jest, even as a joke, okay? Never to lie to another person. The corresponding black deed is to intentionally deceive your teacher or any other person similar to that, okay? Intentionally deceive your teacher in any way, okay? These are opposites. You have to avoid one and you have to try to achieve the other, okay? It says, and other holy beings, okay? Number 2. The white deed is to try to get other people to aspire to this Bodhisattva principle. Hey, look, spend your whole life serving other people, every moment of your life. Try to become a holy person and then try to help other people on the path to be happy. Okay? That's to try to get other people to do that. The negative one there, the black deed, the corresponding black deed, is to cause another person to regret some good thing they've done. Okay? That's like the ultimate black deed you can do. If someone has done something virtuous and you're like scoffing at them or trying to convince them that that's not such a good thing to do or something like that, okay? I think most often it happens in modern world called scoffing, you know, and it's like considered sophisticated to scoff at religious people. In New York especially, you know, did you hear what Vilma Stayana hasn't missed a class in 7 years? You're like, yeah, but she probably didn't get to see all those TV shows, you know. You know, just to scoff at somebody and say, yeah, I can't believe she's so stupid. You know, she's never going to get a degree out of this place. She's never going to make any money out of that. Why is she doing that? You know, and to scoff. I mean, scoffing is like the old, it's a very popular modern thing, and then you cause a person to regret something good they did. Okay? Number 3. Actually, number 3 is why I went over the black and white ones, because it's my favorite vow of all time. Okay? It says, as you walk around New York City, then every person you meet, try to imagine that they could very well be an enlightened being already. Okay? Just every time you run into a person, even if it's literal, okay, it happens in New York, you know, boom. You say, look at them, and they're cursing at you, and you say, now, hold on, don't yell back. This could be an enlightened being, okay? Like, every particular person you meet, you're like, okay, the odds are small on this one, okay? Okay? But the odds is there, okay? There's always some odds. Okay, there's always odds. Okay, just remember that. Any particular person you meet could be, yeah, could be, okay? And then they say do it with buildings and trees and the sky and the ocean and the Hudson River and everything else. Imagine, hey, if I was in the right frame of mind, this place could be the ultimate paradise. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing to say it's not, okay? Maybe I just haven't seen it yet, okay? So as you walk around, even this school, okay? I mean, technically speaking, you know, the Bodhisattva vows are being described for one of the first times in the United States in this school. This school is already like a sacred place. Maybe it was, when they say out in Sedona, they love this kind of stuff, a vortex. You know, like this is an axis. There's a big axis going to the school, and maybe this is a holy place. Like maybe the Navajo once had Hogan here. So, you know what I mean? And we think, you're supposed to think like that, okay? You're supposed to think like that. If you take this vow, you're supposed to think like that. Meaning, yeah, maybe this is a holy place, disguised as a public school 168 or whatever it is, okay? And you keep this vow by walking around all day long, and every time you bump in, you know, every time you see a subway, hey, who knows? Maybe it's Manjushri's sun chariot. I'm just not at the level yet. Okay? And it's a very, very healthy vow. It's a very healthy way to think as you walk around New York City. Okay? What's the opposite of that is it's supposed to be a very, very evil thing to say something out of anger to a bodhisattva. Now, I remember hearing this vow for the first time. I was sitting in Rinpoche's kitchen before they built the whole place. There used to be this little tiny house. Rinpoche was in the back bedroom where I live, and I'm out on the front table there, and I say, oh, Rinpoche, he was Geshe La at the time, how do I know who's a bodhisattva? And he says, you don't. You know? Anyway, supposed to be a special bad deed to say something out of anger to a true bodhisattva, someone who's already had a direct experience of actual bodhicitta, okay? Number four, white deed number four. Total honesty towards every person you ever meet, period. 100% honest with them, okay? Mentally and verbally. The mental part is the hardest, okay? 100% honest towards other people. Does this mean 100% frank towards them? Do you like my new dress? You know? It doesn't mean that, okay? That's not dishonest to say, I saw your mother the other day. Okay? You know what I mean? You don't have to say that's the ugliest thing I ever saw, okay? That's not part of the vow. What it means is that just, you know, within the normal social thing, you don't insult people directly like that. You know what I mean? But you just change the subject or get out of it. But you don't lie. Can't lie. Okay, just total... You know what I'm talking about. It's not the dress question. It's the, you know, hey, are you going to show up this weekend and help us out with that? And say, oh, yeah, sure. You know, and in your mind, you're like, yeah, after I go to the movie if I have any extra time, you know. Okay. All right. And in your mind, you're not saying what you really think. You see what I mean? Or what you really intend. And that, then you're being dishonest. Okay. Discrepancy between what you know to be true and what your mouth is saying. Okay? That's the definition of a lie in Buddhism. Okay. Did you have a question? It's probably the dress question, I bet. Okay. Last one. That was four, right? Oh, that's the antidote for the black deed of what? Acting in a devious way towards anyone. Now, how's that different from the one... Didn't we have one like that? Devious in this case means, and this is very delicate, having any interaction with another person without standing there as you're talking to them about what's for dinner and calculating what you can do to help them get enlightened. Now this is a hard one to keep, okay? I'll say it again. Anytime you have any interaction with another person, you are not thinking, I have a transaction with this person now. I'm having a transaction with this person. You know, I know that if I'm really nice to Bonnie Moore, she will check 5,000 more papers and fill 5,000 more notebooks. You know? And to think in any kind of terms about getting something out of them, money, food, attention, fame, and not be actually standing there and calculating, what's the best thing I can do to get her enlightened the fastest in the next... What's the best thing I can say in the next 5 minutes to help this person get enlightened? You see what I mean? Is breaking this vow. And that's what devious means. Devious means like to use other people rather than to be calculating in a different way. What's the one thing I can say to this person in the next 2 minutes that would help them get enlightened the most? And I'm not saying that you bother your friends with your Buddhism. You know you're not supposed to do that, right? It's not like, oh, please come to class, you know. You got to learn about samskaras. You know, and they're like... It's not like that. It's like, hey, share your coffee with that other guy. You know, there's something... Even something small. but something to get them to do a good thing. You see what I mean? Like, devious in this sense means not to be calculating what you can do to help them get enlightened, but rather be calculating something else. You know, what can I get out of this person? What can I get out of this relationship? What can I get out of this transaction? Okay? Rather to have this constant calculation in your mind, what does this person need next to get enlightened? You know what I mean? In my best ability, to the best of my knowledge. Okay? And it might be something tiny. You know, it might be, hey, could you hold this flower for me? You know, and then they touch it and you think, okay, got you in 24 lifetimes. You took the flower, you know, and then thinking like that, calculating like that, okay? Those are the four white deeds and the four black deeds. Those are also bodhisattva vows. I'm going to let you do the rest, let's see, in your breakout sessions, okay? I personally like the 10th question, which is all the things, the conditions that help you break your vows. What do you, and I'm not going to give you all of them, I'll let your teachers do that, but what do you guess the first reason why most people break their vows is? They simply never heard them. They went to an initiation for $18. The guy flew into town, flew out of town. He rang that bell like crazy. And he sprayed all this stuff on them. And he's a personal friend of His Eminence, the blah, blah, blah. And he didn't tell me what vows I took. Okay? That's the best way to break your vows. Is just not to know them. Okay? So that's a... Did I just break a first bodhisattva vow?
No.
Awful close. Okay. I'm just kidding, okay? Okay. I have something to write during the break. Okay, anyway. I didn't mean it, okay? I'm just... If there were such a thing. Okay. Anyway, but the best way to break your vows is not to ever learn them. Okay, and that's what this class is for. That's why you're here. Okay? All right, take a break, and then after that we'll do the breakout session. Okay? Okay, very short tonight. We're about to enter the season called Yarne. Say Yarne.
Yarne
is the in the ancient Vinaya custom called the rainy season retreat. And in the old days, the monks and nuns during this summer period would actually try to do a longish, like 1 to 3 month retreat indoors. And I think part of the reason is that you don't want to step on the many bugs that are growing during the rainy season and stuff. But the whole idea is that you get a quiet summer. And you spend a certain time renewing your vows, renewing your relationship with the other monks and nuns, and you spend time together and like that. Then following that is a thing called Gaye. Say Gaye. By the way, yarn means summer, ne means retreat or to stay. Gaye, gak means the restrictions, ye means are opened. Gaye. So in the monastery, the guy was shocked. You know, during Gaye. By good luck, I shut up on Gaye. And Gaye is, you can listen to radios, which otherwise you can't. You can play board games. Suddenly, everybody has a board game available. There's this thing called Karim, you know, that looks like billiards, but cheaper. And people can tell stories. And I remember visiting the former abbot, very severe former abbot, and he was on the front porch of his house playing this billiards game with these kids, you know. And I said, Chula Menshona Kandedu, which means, he got all red. It means, what are you going to do if water catches on fire? Which is a Tibetan way to say, if the abbot's playing games, then, you know, the strictest abbot in the monastery is ex-abbot. Then what about the rest? He said, hey, Gaye. You know, and Gaye means things that people can play soccer, for example. You're not allowed to play otherwise. Stuff like that. So for a week or 2 weeks, you can't drink alcohol or go see movies or anything like that. But everything is relaxed. And people have a good time. And I think the one thing about a Tibetan monastery that I think distinguishes it from some other traditions that I've visited is this recognition that there's a time to have a good time, you know what I mean? And that there's a time to relax. And I think even the ancient Vinaya principle is do a kick-ass retreat for 1 to 3 months and then know how to relax. You see what I mean? And we've been, the reason for this series of talks after the classes was to talk about the future of Buddhism in America. We haven't instituted yet proper ways of relaxing. You see what I mean? Like, you meet Dharma students who are trying to practice all day long. We personally, the people who work on the classes, we work 7 days a week, we work 18 hours a day on these laptops, and we do hard meditation, hard study. But I think what has to happen in America, and I don't know, we have to design a gaya. You see, I mean, we have to design into the system in America appropriate ways of relaxing and letting people let off steam. And every great religious tradition has their festivals, you know, like Christmas time or Easter or things like that, when people can relax and in a spiritual way. Munlam Chemo. The Munlam Chemo was instituted by Jetsun Kapa. Jetsun Kapa was a severe lama, and he founded the three great Gelugpa monasteries in Lhasa. He was strict, and he worked hard. But if you read his biography, he took his vacations too, and he also knew how to relax. And in the Munlam Chemo, which is a 3-week religious festival in the capital city, the police force is required to turn over the jails and all the uniforms to these guys called Duttobs, which are monks. And they wear these big shoulder pads, like football pads under here, so they look like that. And then they hold these big sticks called karwa. And then they run the city for 3 weeks. And, you know, like goofballs. These are the goofball monks in the monastery. They get to run the whole municipal system for 3 weeks, and they have a good time. People have festivals, there are religious processions, they put huge paintings on the Potala, like 500 foot tankas. People have butter sculpture, torma making contests between the great monasteries. The monks get together and debate in public and try to make a good show for the people. And I think, I don't know how it's going to happen, but I think we have to build into Buddhism in the West a way that in their personal practice people can take a break. In Sera Monastery, every night until 1 or 2 o'clock, you can hear people walking around the monastery memorizing their texts. But Tuesday is market day. And on Tuesday, nobody recites anything. You know what I mean? And that's the way it should be. You see, every scholar, no matter how hardcore they are, on Tuesday they relax, you know what I mean? And they have a day that they take their rest. And on Tuesday night, you don't hear anything. You don't hear one guy walking around the monastery, because they've also been taught by their lamas how to take their rest. This is something in the monastery that you get from your, what we call your house teacher, your Gergen. He may not be a scholar, but he's a mom. And he watches out for you, and he makes sure that you don't get too intense also. Like, he might order you to go on a camping trip. They're called linka. And, you know, you go down to the river, you take a tent, you take 2 days worth of food, and you jump around in the river and play around, and then you sit around and cook food together, and you have a potluck, and all the members of your class go, and you relax for 2 days. And this is a part of monastery life. It's a part of the Vinaya cycle. So I think we have to institute it on 3 levels. I don't know how yet. You know, I'm sure Dr. Sykes would be a good consultant. Maybe he's doing it right now, I think. But on a personal level, how to take proper rest and how to take proper care of yourself. Because resting is important. You know, how to properly take a rest without endangering your vows. You know what I mean? How to take a good, proper relaxation so that you come back fresher. In Master Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva Life, he talks about the need to take care of yourself and to take care of your mind and your body and the need to relax sometimes. And he says, you know, I think Lama Yeshe said something that Master Shantideva would have said. He said, if you've been working hard and you've been studying hard and you just went to work for 8 hours and you come home, don't sit down and meditate because you won't be able to. Go to a couch, lay down on the couch, make yourself a nice coffee, sit back with your feet up on the arm of the couch and think about helping living beings as you drink your coffee. You know what I mean? And Master Shantideva is saying things very similar. So I think we have to institute a way that individuals, as part of their daily practice or weekly practice, have a regular time that they can relax and nice ways of relaxing. Like in the monastery, during Gaye, out come all these birth stories of the Buddha. You see? They're not studying, they're studying advanced philosophy all year long. Then they put those books away and they pull out all the birth stories, and some older monk will come and all the little monks will gather around and they'll just sit and tell stories about how Lord Buddha fed himself to the tigress, or, you know, and then you go up to your Gergen, your house teacher, and he says, pick a page, and you close your eyes and you open the book and they just start the story from there and they relax. They know how to relax. And I think it's a problem in Western Buddhism right now that we don't have a system yet for personal relaxation during the week, proper relaxation, not in excess, okay? And then some kind of thing that happens on a cyclical basis. In each great religion, there are festivals, or there are times when you bake a cake, or you have gifts, or, you know, I mean, we have to see what we do about that. I would suggest on the major, there are 5 or 6 major Buddhist holidays during the year, and we have to figure out some kind of way of making it festivious, anyway, fun, okay, and in a proper way. And then on a long-term basis, people have to know how to take retreats, I suggest twice a year, long retreats, when you're quiet and you're not talking and you're thinking and you're alone and you're not seeing other people. And I think there has to be this whole thing built into American Buddhism where on an annual basis, on a monthly basis, on a weekly basis, on a daily basis, you are taking your rest in an appropriate way. And it makes you a better Buddhist. You know what I mean? When you get back from doing that, you are actually much healthier, much happier. It doesn't work to try to meditate all day. It doesn't work to try to study philosophy all day. You've got to have some kind of relaxation, and I think some kind of exercise built into the thing. In Tibet, they do prostrations. There's a special board. It's about 8 feet long. It's about 3 feet wide. And you do 1,000 prostrations. And the young monks do their debating. And this also gets your frustrations out and your tension out of your body. I think we need some kind of thing that we develop that, you know, the young monks use it for getting their frustration out, you know, and it's very healthy for them. And then the older monks will be doing prostrations or at about 8 o'clock every night in Sera Monastery and Jebung, Ganden, the older monks go for a walk. It's called Cham Cham Dogyenbe. Cham Cham means it's a very pleasant thing, and the older monks, like, they might be holding hands, and they're walking a mile down the road, and they're just looking at the fresh air and talking about things that they want to work on and relaxing. And then they come back and they all feel good. They might, actually at Sera, it's built into the monastery that you can circle the monastery. There's a special road, and you might do 20 rounds. And you see the older monks, they'll try to do 3 or they'll try to do 5. But the point is they get outside, they get fresh air, they get some exercise, they relax mentally. Then they go back home and do their tantric rituals, and they're fresh and they're doing them very powerfully, and you can hear them, you know, late into the night doing their tantric stuff, you know. And I think we need to think about that. I don't have any brilliant suggestions. I just know that we have to do it, and we're not doing it. And you meet many Westerners who are frustrated or loony. They're like tense, their practice is tense, their faces are tense, you know, they're having all these problems because they don't know how to relax in a proper way. So I think we have to think about that as an organization, as a religion, as a on a national level, on a personal level. We have to figure out how to relax properly. Okay, yeah. You know, down in New Jersey, Rinpoche used to give a 10-day initiation. He used to give 10-day initiation teachings every year for the first 15 years. And the last day was always goof-off day. And we would go to a local park, and the vegetarians would play against the meat eaters. Baseball. And Rinpoche was the umpire, and he had the greatest fun. And after we started beating them continually, they stopped doing it. So the vegetarians were beating the meat eaters. They said, you know, you had to eat meat to be strong, and we would just wipe them out every year, and then they stopped doing it. But anyway, yeah, we need something like that. So think about it. I'm just throwing it out as a part of the future of American Buddhism. It's something we have to think about. You see a lot of American Buddhists walking around all tense, and they don't know how to... Their inability to relax in the ways that are already built into Tibetan Buddhism, because we don't have those available to us. We just like 365 days a year trying to meditate and study 8 hours a day, and you need to build in some kind of mechanism for people to relax properly. So I'm just... That's one of my ideas about the future of American Buddhism. I think next week I'd like to talk about forms of Buddhism. You know, what form will the music take? What form will the rituals take? Things like that, okay? Okay, we'll do a prayer. You ready, Kuntala? Thank you.